May it please the court, this appeal is from the second of two identical condemnation actions filed against my client by the City of Milford, one in 2006, one in 2007. Our first point of argument is that the city violated its charter by failing to approve the filing of the condemnation by resolution versus through a motion on a voice vote. The charter, section 4.11, lists eight specific actions that must be approved by ordinance. Following that, it says that other than those eight, the other actions by the city council may be done either by ordinance or resolution.
Well, could you tell me what's the difference between a resolution and a motion?
Well, the lower court concluded that there essentially was none, but the case law on the subject seems to suggest that a motion basically is bringing a matter before a body to indicate a particular action, whereas a resolution is something of a more formal nature that does result in a written formal document being put together, and in the context of a condemnation, that would be something that would identify the property to be taken, the purpose for which it's to be taken, those types of things.
So here there was a motion which I assume was voted in a favorable fashion, right?
There was.
After the motion was made, there was a favorable vote.
After many attempts.
Okay. Was there no written record of that motion?
There are minutes. The vote was not to approve any formal resolution or document. And in the Wilmington Parking Authority case, the condemnation in that situation was approved by resolution. Many of the cases that I've cited refer to resolutions being adopted by the governing body that identify what's to be taken, why it's to be taken, describe the project. We're arguing that the least a property owner could expect if their property is to be taken is that there would at least be some formality to the matter that would explain to that person and the public the reason for the condemnation. In fact, one of the cases that I didn't find a Delaware appellate decision on the subject of whether a motion essentially is the equivalent of a resolution, but there are cases that suggest that when a charter contains limitations, that those limitations tend to proscribe the limits of the authority of council. They must act within those limitations. I believe that was the Schatt case. And Pierre-Karski case said it described a resolution as being something that is of a more formal nature.
Mr. Griffin, what did the record, or what did the minutes show in terms of the vote that was taken?
Well, it showed that a motion was made to reauthorize, and this was on October 27th of 2007. The motion was to reauthorize the filing of a condemnation that had already happened in July of that same year.
Resolution wasn't used. There was just a recital.
A roll call on the voice vote. Council voted in April to authorize the condemnation filing. They voted again in August. They voted in April to file it. It in July.
That's my second question. In any of the previous votes, including the one that was reauthorized, that is the original vote, was there a resolution?
No resolution.
Okay, so that being the case, then the issue is whether, as a legal matter, the term resolution, as it appears in the ordinance or in the Milford
charter,
is the same as a motion. That is our issue.
That's the legal issue, yes.
Okay. And as I understand it, there's no dispute among the two sides that the law is not uniform on that issue.
Well, there's some cases that go both ways from different states. There's a very interesting case that in Texas, it's the city of Center. And what was at stake there was the council voting to approve a purchase of land under an agreeable contract of sale that had been negotiated with a private person to sell their land to the city. And in that case, the court ruled that when you're agreeing to purchase land, it should be done by resolution. I would think that if you're voting to condemn land against the will of the owner, at least the same formality would be observed as would be observed with an agreeable purchase.
Are you able to articulate any prejudice that occurred to your client as a result of this action being taken by motion and voice vote as distinguished from a resolution?
Well, I can't say that I can indicate prejudice from that, but we're saying that the cumulative effect of all the matters that we're using as grounds for appeal were to the detriment of my client.
Right, but that would be that's the same prejudice that would result.
I think the prejudice,
even if there had been a resolution.
I think the prejudice is more to the vitality and integrity of the Milford Charter, because saying that a motion is the same as a resolution when the charter says it must be done by ordinance or resolution is denigrating or diminishing the integrity of the charter.
Is resolution a defined term in the charter?
It is defined. In fact, the city has relied on the definition in Black's Law Dictionary, but I think that definition favors us rather than them, because it says it's a formal opinion or expression of the will of council adopted by vote. So the word formal expression of opinion suggests.
I understand that the term resolution can be defined by the dictionary, but my question was, is the term resolution a defined term in the charter, like in a contract where you have certain defined terms that then you...
No, Your Honor.
And is the word motion ever mentioned in the charter?
In section 4.10, this deals with procedure, and it mentions the word motion twice, does not define it. In the immediately following section 4.11, that's the point where it said certain actions must be done by ordinance, and those that aren't done by ordinance can be done either by ordinance or resolution.
Now, is motion a defined term in the charter?
No, Your Honor. But it does say that for those terms, one would look to Robert's Rules of Order. The charter says that. And when you look to Robert's Rules of Order, obviously resolution and motion are defined, and resolution is defined as something of a more formal nature, suggesting a written document adopted for that particular proposition then voted on.
Can I ask a practical question here?
Yes.
Assuming you prevail on this point, what does that do? Does that just require the whole process to start over again, or what?
In the cases where the courts ruled that a resolution was required where a motion was used, it did result in the case being dismissed or terminated, and then the governing body would have to make a decision whether to reinstitute proceedings.
So your answer is yes, the process would have to start all over again?
Yes. Going to our next point, that the condemnation was not for a public purpose, was a pretext to benefit a private party. We're not challenging the fact that the city had the power to condemn to install or expand sewer. What we're challenging is that the fact is that there was a primary beneficiary here other than the public in the manner in which this happened. So we're challenging the means and mechanics, not the ability to condemn for sewer purposes.
One thing I'm having trouble understanding on that point is whenever a municipality or another state subdivision makes the decision to install a sewer line up to point A, it benefits everyone up to point A. Everyone from point A to point B doesn't have a sewer. They're not benefited, yet indirectly they're paying for it. How is this any different?
Well, it's different because the city, when my client's land was annexed, asked my client to sign an agreement, which my client did. That agreement said that my client would be responsible for installing the sewer within its development of 158 acres. It went forward based on that, and approximately 2 years after the annexation, the city approved my client's development plan. In approving the development plan, it was agreed and made part of the plan approved by the city's governing body that my client, in return for being able, having to put in all the sewer and a utility infrastructure, was entitled to determine the order in which to develop the 13 phases. He determined and began developing his property before a development plan was approved for the neighboring subdivision. He was, by that time, he was in phase 5 out of 13. He had not developed the land adjacent to the neighboring subdivision. There was a gap of about 1,500 feet. So what happened here is that when the neighboring subdivision came along and asked, when the neighboring subdivision was annexed, they were told at the annexation hearing that they would be getting sewer through my client's development when my client brought the sewer line up to the common boundary line, and that if they needed sewer before then, they would need to go down the road, get it from another subdivision. It would have been a longer run. They would have had to put in a pump station. But that was their option. They understood that. The minutes indicate that they acknowledged that. However, when the neighboring subdivision was approved, they immediately demanded sewer when the city said, well, we can't give it to you right now because my client hadn't built it, hadn't filled in this 1,500-foot gap. They file suit against my client and the city. That suit was settled by a private settlement agreement, which was never disclosed to us, under which it basically gave...
Well, how do you settle a suit without all the parties?
Well, it was settled. There was a private settlement agreement that was never filed with the court. What was filed with the court was a stipulation of dismissal. I did sign that. But I was never made aware that there was an underlying private settlement agreement. That's part of the record in the case. And what that private settlement agreement did was it completely violated the agreements the city made with my client. And before entering into it, the city should have come back to my client and said, we've decided to go another way. We can't live by the agreement we made with you. That's not what they did.
Mr. Griffin, all of that... All of what you told us sounds like you're arguing your estoppel point, but I thought what you were doing was answering a question about proper purpose. I'm confused.
Okay.
I thought your purpose argument was that the city, condemned this property to benefit itself in its capacity as a litigant because it had made... It had undertaken to see to it that there would be an acceleration of the sewer infrastructure on key properties side of the boundary line.
Well, perhaps I did get ahead of myself. On the public purpose argument, the cases of Randolph versus Wilmington Parking Authority and
the... Well, I understand the concept. I just don't understand how you're applying it here. I mean, this, whatever the city of Milford is doing, it's doing as a sovereign, is it not?
It is.
And if it's doing that, whatever it's doing as a sovereign, on what basis are we to say that it's not acting for a public purpose in condemning a portion of the property on your client's side of the line?
Well, I think the underlying facts suggest that it was condemning my client's property because it was complying with a private settlement agreement it made with the other developer and never disclosed to my client.
What difference does it make if it was disclosed or not? And what difference does it make if it was a private settlement or not, as long as the city was acting in its capacity as sovereign? I mean, aren't you confusing equities with law here?
Well, I think it has to be for a public purpose.
Yes.
And we're saying that this was to benefit a private party. It basically handed to the private party, this settlement agreement handed to the private party the control over when condemnation would be filed or if condemnation would be filed.
Two questions. When did your client first find out about this settlement? And secondly, when it did find out, was any effort made to undo the dismissal, the stipulation of dismissal?
No effort was made to undo that. We found out about a week before the city filed condemnation, and my client was provided with a copy of it by the former city manager, who said, in all fairness, I think you should know about this. Obviously, we didn't until that was done.
What record was made in connection with this lawsuit?
Pardon me?
That is, what is the record? Was it the record of the proceedings before the city? Or is it just a complaint and, in effect, a motion to dismiss a complaint?
Complaint, answers filed by the city and by my client, and then the stipulation followed by stipulation of dismissal.
That's the record?
Yes. There's no factual hearing on the case.
All right. Now, to the extent you haven't already done so, would you tell us or summarize for us your estoppel argument?
Okay. On the estoppel argument, although I know equitable estoppel is not a doctrine that's favored, we think there certainly is precedent that supports that. We believe that the lower court incorrectly characterized our arguments that we were putting forth as we were alleging equitable estoppel below. The court said, no, you're confused. You're arguing promissory estoppel. The city never promised not to condemn. Therefore, there's no promissory estoppel. Our argument was that there was equitable estoppel, that my client lacked the knowledge of the truth of the facts in question. He relied on the conduct of the city, and he suffered a prejudicial change of position.
To what is that prejudicial change of position, precisely? And is there a dollar figure that's attached to it?
In reliance on the agreement the city made with my client, that he was to install the sewer, that he was to control the order of his development, and that the city would not take charge of or use these easements until my client had completed the utilities in each phase. In reliance on those agreements, my client set about developing their land, and with the knowledge and belief that they had the ability, the true flexibility, to decide when to develop what phase and when to hand over the easements. That turned out not to be the case, because all of that was undone by the fact that the city, approximately 5 years after it entered into agreements with my client, entered into directly conflicting agreements with the adjoining developer.
What I'm hearing is that your client lost its ability to control the direction and pace of the development.
Yes.
It's distinguished from having to pay out of pocket money that it would not otherwise have had to pay. Is that correct?
Well, part of the agreement was that my client could make modifications to its development plan.
I'm just asking about dollars.
Well, the money spent were truly the money spent in development. I can't say that my clients lost money because of what the city did, but it spent several millions of dollars in reliance on a set of agreements it made with the city that allowed my client certain latitude in the way it would carry out and conduct its development activities.
And where in the record is it demonstrated that your client relied in that way? That is, would have behaved differently had it known then what it knows now?
The factual hearing that the court relied on was one from September 2006, and there's testimony in the record, and I believe that's in the appendix also, that as to the monies my client spent, as to the fact that my client testified at that hearing that if they
So there is a factual record,
yes,
then?
Yes. It was the record in the first condemnation hearing, but the lower court relied on that in deciding the second condemnation hearing. I asked for a factual hearing in the second condemnation, and that request was denied, and the court said that it would take judicial notice of the facts in the first hearing and rely on those.
Mr. Griffin, your time is up. Unfortunately, you were talked through your rebuttal time as well, so
thank you.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs. My name is Tim Willard. I'm the current city solicitor for the city of Milford. Just to clarify, as to the record, you know there was a previous condemnation hearing that was dismissed on technicality when Mr. Griffin filed the appeal on Judge Bradley's last order. We moved to dismiss it because it wasn't done pursuant to a final order, and the interlocutory rules weren't followed. At that time, he didn't request that the transcript of that prior hearing be brought up. In fact, part of his argument was that he didn't get a hearing. When he appealed again, I'm the one that requested that the transcript of the prior hearing be included because Judge Bradley clearly relied on that pursuant to Rule 71-1. I'd like to start with the estoppel argument. Judge Bradley found that there was no detrimental reliance, and I think that is significant, and we agree with his decision, obviously. The defendant or appellant is claiming that he detrimentally relied on that note or the ability to preclude an adjacent subdivision to be connected. That note or that condition, which allowed him supposedly to deny the city to do that, also said that the sewer shall be connected.
I'm not sure. What do you mean deny the city to do that? What does that mean?
Part of the appellant's case is that they had an agreement that they would be able to preclude the city from connecting if they didn't develop that. So in essence, they could say, well, we're not going to develop that, you can't connect. That's how they were denying us the ability to connect. But it also said that the city had discretion whether or not to move those easements. And in those final site plans, those utility easements were located and identified and recorded. In addition, this final site plan was fixed. So in essence, his flexibility argument as a detrimental reliance argument doesn't make sense.
You're talking about Note 8 or Note,
yes,
6? Or
I believe it's Note 8. I don't have it right before me. There's 7 and 8. But
can I stop you right there?
Yes,
because
ma'am.
Something about this doesn't make sense at a common sense level. And so what I'm trying to figure out is the reason why we're here and the reason why Key is aggrieved is that another developer is going ahead with development and is going to be competition for the development that Key is pursuing, and that they thought that they were going to be able to stop anybody else from developing anything until they were finished.
I made that point in my brief, and I think that's a very reasonable inference, because if you look at the appellant's arguments that somehow they were aggrieved or it doesn't make sense because they didn't have flexibility because the city had the ability to decide whether they could change their easements or not. In addition, what's interesting when Justice Jacobs is asking about value on all of this, it is relevant to their argument, but they really aren't pursuing it. In other words, there was no compensation hearing for y'all to decide, you know, for example, they produced an engineer saying, if you make this connection, it'll damage our whole system. There's no money damage. It's just, well, we had this right, and it's unfair to deny it.
I understand the argument, Mr. Willard, to be that the acceleration of this, you know, the sewer construction will reduce or diminish the options or alternatives that Mr. Griffin's client would otherwise have had. Is that factually accurate?
Yeah, but it doesn't make sense because the easement is...
I'm sorry, is it factually accurate?
Yes, sir.
All right.
I guess my point is the easements are fixed, and the city has discretion whether or not they move them or not. And they have a final site plan showing the layout of those phases that are interceding. And it's pretty clear by the city's actions over the last 3 years that we want to make this connection, that they're not going to entertain that flexibility.
That's another point that's confusing, at least to me. There is an easement that's already laid out, correct?
Two of them, yes.
All right. But the easement is only for a 20-foot space.
Correct.
And there was no easement for a 40-foot wide space, which was necessary for the infrastructure of a sewer construction.
Yeah, and I think that does highlight the appellant's point that the idea...
Before you comment or editorialize, let me just ask the question. In that, so as far as the difference between the 20 and the 40 feet, you know, that differential... There was, is it fair to say there was no easement?
No, I think there was an existing easement for 20 feet.
But not for 40?
Correct.
Okay, so to that extent, that is for the incremental 20 feet, there was no easement laid out?
Correct.
All right. And does that fact have legal significance?
It really doesn't have legal significance. It has factual significance because it tends to support the appellant's argument that the intent was that they would put it in and then we would take it over. And as Judge Bradley found, there maybe wasn't mutual assent here or at least the timing didn't work out. But as you pointed out, it's somewhat confusing dealing with these equitable and contractual issues when we're acting as a sovereign to connect to a public use that's statutorily mandated in our charter. And
please
it's
tell
not,
me you're not making the argument that when the sovereign enters into a contract and the terms of the contract become inconvenient for the sovereign just does what the sovereign wants to do anyway?
Absolutely not. No, sir. But I do think that the right of a sovereign of eminent domain is something that, you know, it predates the founding of this country, and it's an important right that is limited by our Constitution, both national and state. And what is important is there's a legislatively defined public use that the court's review should be as to the compensation, the just compensation.
Can I get to the motion business? I understand that the lower court said motion, resolution, same difference. But the charter says you shall do this by resolution or ordinance, and you go ahead and do it by some other means that you now are saying is the equivalent of a resolution. Isn't this the kind of situation where a sovereign acting in its capacity to take property from a private landowner should do it right? And, you know, if the charter says resolution, you've got to have a resolution. You've got to have a document that says at the top resolution, even if the subject matter is what was covered in a motion, that you have to, it's like a deed. If you don't sign it in the right places and you don't have it witness, then it's not valid. Why shouldn't that apply here?
Well, it's a good question. I think that in the Pekarsky case, I think it is, the Delaware case where they dealt with this somewhat, and it's the difference between temporary and permanent, I think, is why it should not. The charter simply says these are the things you need to do by ordinance, and these are, and everything else is by resolution.
Can be by resolution.
By resolution. Right. And there are multiple, you know, having spent, you know, many a night in Milford, like they take a lot of action by resolution. It would be incredibly burdensome for them to prepare resolutions for all the action they take. So your question is, well,
Stop. So you're telling me that as a matter of practice, the city routinely does not do or make a resolution to conduct its activity, even though the charter says you have to do it by ordinance or resolution. If they don't have to do it by ordinance, then what they actually do it by is by motion.
Yes, I am saying that because the motion is you know, the motion is just a precursor to a resolution. Let's move to resolve. There are things that are not done by ordinance that are done by more formal resolution. But I think what the city decides is, and in some of the case law that was cited, that where resolution are needed are for things that are more permanent, like a recorded document or, say, rules or laws that people rely on over time. A resolution, on the other hand, is an act to do something, and then it's done.
Well, but here's the problem. Your charter says do things by ordinance or resolution. Your charter, to my understanding, doesn't say, and for stuff that isn't going to last that long, you can just do it by motion. So you've kind of engrafted a new layer of less formality, and you've explained it as being, well, you know, we do a lot of these, and, you know, we only do resolutions for the things that are going to be recorded that are going to last a long time. Well, that, you know, that makes perfectly good sense, but that's not what your charter says.
Well, if you conclude that there's no substantive difference between a motion and a resolution, then it's okay, and I guess that's what we've done. I know that doesn't maybe satisfy your answer, but
that's one of the things we've been trying to get at is what does the charter suggest is the difference, if any, between a resolution and a motion, because we have to assume it's no accident that the charter mentions ordinance, resolution, motion. And for some of us, although it's been years ago, who've represented county governments, we understand that resolutions are normally tied to notice requirements. They're more formal. They exercise the authority of the government in a certain way, as opposed to, let's say, a motion to adjourn or a motion to honor so-and-so for their 20 years of service to the county or a motion to turn the lights out every day in the county building at 5 o'clock. A resolution, on the other hand, deals with subject matter that's often posted in public notice so people know which meetings they're interested in coming to because a substantial action may be taken that will affect their interest. Now, does the charter make that kind of distinction between a motion and a resolution or not?
It does not. It simply says that these actions will be done by ordinance and everything else by resolution.
But tied to ordinance and tied to resolution, are there any statutory or other code provisions outside the charter that suggest what subject matter can and can't be handled by resolution?
Not that I'm aware of, and that's why as counsel for the city, if I'm advising them on whether a resolution or a motion is necessary, it will be for what it's used for. For example, if Chapter 61 of Title 10 said, you know, my complaint to condemn these two easements required authorization, you know, I would include that, I would ask for a resolution, or when, you know, we need to transfer property. I mean, that's how I would deal with it.
Where do you go to find out the guideline for when a resolution is required as opposed to a motion? And if the ruling below is correct, you don't need to go to any guideline because one's tantamount to being the other. Doesn't make any difference. So you suggest there is some kind of guideline for distinguishing between the two.
Well, we have the Bukerski guideline, which is just the temporary versus permanent analysis. But I really think it's got to be fact driven, depending on what the action is going to be used for.
Mr. Willard, yes. I'd like to get back for a moment to the estoppel issue. You know, the Superior Court analyzed that claim in terms of promissory estoppel, Mr. Griffin's client argues that that's the wrong cubbyhole because promissory estoppel is merely a substitute for consideration. But in any event, is it not the case that this estoppel argument is grounded upon a claim that your client, the city, contractually promised, that Key Properties or predecessor would have control over the direction and pace of the development, which would necessarily include sewer infrastructure?
Yes, I think it is, based on their estoppel argument. Whether it's equitable estoppel or promissory estoppel,
You understand that to be their argument.
Yes.
My question was there, in fact, a contractual promise by your client to give Key Properties that freedom, that latitude?
Arguably there was, but I argue in my brief, and I will here today, that it was ambiguous and illusory. In other words, they had a note on there that said you can't connect until we've completed this, and that would be the term. Until we've completed this, you can connect. The note also suggests that connection shall be through there.
Okay, so the note's not clear.
Well,
or maybe it isn't clear, but Mr. Griffin's client has a clear interpretation of it. What's your side's interpretation?
It wasn't clear. In fact, we thought we would have the ability to connect, and because it gave them the absolute right, and that's where our illusory argument comes in, total control over that condition, the argument is that it should be voided. Finally, at the end of the day,
so you're saying the contract or the record does support Mr. Griffin's contractual argument, or it doesn't, but even if it's found to support, then it's void?
Exactly. And also,
is it not also your position that, you know, as Judge Bradley appeared to find, that what occurred here was really not within the contemplation of the parties at the time the development plan was approved, the notes were signed off on?
Well, clearly, I think Mr. Griffin's client had a different idea than perhaps the city. I mean, you got to keep in mind that, you know, this is 10 years ago. There's a boom in Sussex. Milford's experiencing things that they hadn't experienced in a while. There was a little bit of a learning curve. That's not necessarily an excuse. You know, Hearthstone was approved for about 1,100 units.
All I asked is whether this fact situation was contemplated by the parties when they chose the language of their agreement, which includes the notes.
Note to the extent the timing didn't work out. So, I mean, if you're asking, did we contemplate whether we would have to condemn? Is that your question?
Or take whatever action would be necessary to force Key Properties to accelerate.
At the time that Hearthstone was annexed, it probably wasn't clear. There's evidence in the testimony of the first hearing from the town manager that he said, I think, and it's in my brief, that we'll have to do what we can to get to the easements. There's testimony from Hans Medlarv, who was the engineer at the time, that it is impractical and not acceptable to have any exclusion of easements. You know, in the big scheme of property development and municipalities, including subdivisions, it would be sort of unheard of to allow that. But, I mean, it happened the way it happened. And I think when you look at the estoppel argument, the real key is here there's a lack of detrimental reliance or a change of position. They don't have the flexibility. They've argued they'd want, well, we'd like to have a park or something like that. You certainly could do that with a pipe underneath. They've argued the whole development would not have gone forward. And this is a large development. Would not have gone forward but for this one condition, but it's lacking in testimony to support that, we believe. If I can just touch on the public purpose argument, I think, you know, you have a clear statutory public purpose and well-recognized, it's a health sort of necessity public purpose sewer. In 2.01 of the charter, it includes
Let me interrupt you on that one. I think it can't be questioned that constructing sewers is a public purpose. my question really is that there are all different ways of running the lines. And in light of the obligations that arguably the city undertook with Key, why wasn't the city left with the only remaining way of hooking up the other development would be to go around, and that's more expensive, and it would require a pump station or whatever it would require, but that would be part of what the other developer would have to pay for?
I think at the time it was against the advice of the engineer to do that. It's highly costly. It was the intent that this would work and we wouldn't meet this block. And so what the city has said is we'll pay for it. Okay, they had an understanding that Hearthstone was going to use the expense and build everything. It was just saying, time out, we have this extraordinary rate of condemnation, and we will pay for it. In fact, if you challenge the compensation, we had extensive negotiations on this, tell us what they are. Do you want us to stub it out for you? And we produce engineering agreements. So it is a technical decision on the city's plan point. This is the best way to go, and the costs don't make sense, and we're allowed to do this. And if the issue is cost, let's resolve it. In this particular case, they filed a final order, didn't challenge our appraisal, so you have no record of what the cost will be. They didn't challenge it, which diminishes their arguments that this is really about some harm that they've experienced.
Well, they have an argument that they have been harmed. They just don't argue they've been economically harmed in terms of whether they were paid adequately for the land that was taken. That's my understanding. Justice Berger's point, at least as I understood it, was if anyone wants to breach this agreement and there's a cost to breaching the agreement and chooses to breach it, they have to pay the difference. But they could honor the agreement and pay more for the adjacent Lake Shores or whatever development's called. Either they or that developer could pay more money and hook up to the public sewer in a different way, and that was the city's choice. The city chose instead to allegedly breach their agreement with Key.
I see my time is up, but if I may respond.
Yeah.
It seems to me that, and that is not, I think, a power that the city takes lightly, but the ability to condemn for public purposes involving necessity, like sewer, water, safety, and health is a very important right that they have. And when it is statutorily granted by the legislature, I think that some deference should be given to them in that regard, and that the protection that the landowner has is compensation. I think there's some case law that says if they cannot do it punitively or thoughtlessly. Well, and in this case, I don't think we did.
Do you not understand the argument to be that we don't challenge the city's authority to condemn for sewer? That is a proper purpose. We're saying here that the exercise of that power of condemnation wasn't for the public or the city's benefit. It was for the benefit of the adjacent developer, because by condemning Key's land, the adjacent developer saved money by the alternative of building a pump station and getting access to the sewer in another spot. That's the argument, at least as I understand it.
I understand
that. If the city's using its condemnation power to save a private developer money, how is that a proper exercise of condemnation power?
Well, I think the benefit to a private developer does not defeat the overriding the concern of the city to provide sewer to all its citizens.
But it's simply a timing issue. Sooner or later, the Key property, as developed, would be hooked into the sewer. This was to benefit an earlier development by a neighbor developer. It wasn't for the benefit of the citizens of Milford or Kent and Sussex County as a whole, because eventually, on the timing of Key properties, that property would be hooked to the sewer anyway, and there was an alternative for the lakeshore. development
would be hooked. Well, we don't know if it would or would not. They have the discretion to make that connection or not. It could go on indefinitely.
Well, I thought you said they didn't have discretion, that the city controlled their plan.
Well, their position, what we do control their plan, the location of it and the existence of it. Their argument is they control the use, and they control the use by simply the term that, well, you can't hook up city until we're complete our construction. And if for all our, we could see, maybe it's the economy, but they had no intention of making that interceding phase or connection. So we said time out. We have a duty to all our citizens to provide sewer, and that's why we did, and we said we'll pay for it. Tell us what the costs are. And it wasn't done lightly or cavalierly.
But you do concede that duty to provide sewer could have been satisfied by the Lakeshore developer hooking up at another spot.
Yes, I believe as the engineer testified, anything is possible at costs.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.